play. Laughter forever and skies never gray. But when I'm silent, freed from all care, I discover my home's everywhere. Home is a green hill, home is a wind, low in betrayal, far, far away. Home is the knowledge heaven is near.
Dark eyes in the morning, dark eyes. starlight at end of day. Dark eyes that speak silence, they whisper, come find me. You'll never know true love if you stay.
Now I seek them in the winter time, now I seek them in the spring. Those two dark eyes draw my heart away to where sun and moon sing. I laugh now in the summertime when ripples on the river play. I laugh soaring with the meadowlarks, love has made my heart gay. I laugh soaring with the meadowlarks, love has made my heart gay. I've known them forever, they've haunted my slumber and called to me out of the deeps of space. The love that they promise has helped me remember another time, a caring embrace. Another time, a
you a song first. Jeannie at Ananda asked me to write a song for a bass. And I have to say that usually when people become old, and I'm only 84, but their voices become creaky and they don't have much power. I don't know why, but my voice has become deeper and more powerful, and God knows what it all means, but something's going on around here. Okay, I'll sing you this song. And I haven't rehearsed, so I may make some mistakes. Yeah, give me that one.
And may coax time to stay.
fleeting scenes move by like a dream. Cling not, none will be your home, lest you grieve to be alone. Go within you, there's your home. Life flows on like a river that homes to the sea. One hour winding, bounding through mountain vales. One hour winding through a lea. None may linger on the way. None may coax time to stay. Fleeting scenes move by like a dream. Cling not, none will be your home, lest you grieve to be alone. Go within you, there's your home. This I wish were tighter. This is Sphinx as I put my hand on it. I wish it were tighter. I'd like to stand here.
It doesn't have an adjustment for that.
For tightening?
No, it doesn't have
one. Okay. If this thing keeps sinking, I will probably go sit down. Okay. Today is a very important day in my life, and I hope it's important for some of you. It's the day I met Master, and curiously enough, I'm going to sit down. Bring that chair over. And bring the microphone forward and get rid of this, and okay. What's that?
You don't need that. You have to.
Okay. Well, I said, curiously enough, I am going to sit down. That's not what I really meant. I meant to say, curiously enough, it was a Sunday also. I met Master in the Hollywood Church, and he accepted me that day. And it was obviously a great day in my life. I had never heard of Indian philosophy before. I didn't know any of the Indian terms. I didn't know even about the word guru. In fact, if you had asked me if I wanted a guru, I'd say absolutely not. I don't want anybody to teach me. I want to find the truth for myself. And even today, if yoga teachers or different people ask me, do I need a guru? I say, no, absolutely you don't. Because I can say this, that when I met Master, I was in desperate need of help. And when you reach that point of, I'm sorry, I find it very hard to speak these days. I feel so much bliss in my heart that it's not tears of pain, but tears of joy, and I can't help it. So bear with me. But I felt so desperate to know God that I knew I needed help. When you reach that point, that's when you need a guru. You have to realize I didn't think I needed help because I'd never met anybody from whom I felt I wanted to learn. But when I read Autobiography of a Yogi, it completely transformed my life. I was in New York at the time, and after reading that book, I took the next bus across the country. And when I met Master here in Hollywood Church, the first words I said to him were, I want to be your disciple. Well, let me go back to my own search to give you an idea of why I had reached such a point of desperation to know the truth. I all my life wanted to know truth. I didn't know what truth was, but I wanted to know it. I want to know what really is. And I used to play games with myself, trying to use reason falsely. And it was great fun, but I did it also to convince myself, to show myself, that reason will not give you truth, cannot give you truth. You can play with reason any way you like. So the kind of games I would play would be, because I didn't like spinach as a child, I'd say, "Mother, don't give me spinach. It's green, and green is the color of envy and jealousy. You don't want your son growing up to be envious and jealous, do you?" And she would know I was joking, and I, of course, was joking, but I would use this kind of thing also to make myself, help myself to understand I won't find the truth by reason. You have to know it in your heart. When you recognize something in your heart, then you have what you're looking for. And so all the schools of philosophy to which I was exposed, all the ways of thinking and so on, I just couldn't feel it, and I just rejected it. And the first thing I rejected was God, because the way it was presented to me in my dry as dusk Episcopalian church, was not attractive. And so when I was seeking truth, I began by eliminating God. That's the first thing. Because reason told me that this kind of God, at least, cannot be. So I started with science. I wanted to become an astronomer. And I was trying to grind my own lens and so on. But I finally realized that it makes no difference how big the galaxy is or the universe is. It doesn't matter whether 100 billion galaxies or only one. We need a truth that is not some sort of abstraction. We need something that will change us. The truth we learn has to be something that affects us for the better. So I left science and I tried political systems and I toyed with communism and other methods and tried to create political systems of my own. And I saw that people don't change for the system they follow. The system rather reflects who they are. But we can't change ourselves by changing the place we live in, the way we live, the society we create. We can only change ourselves from within. So I felt that's not the answer. What is the answer? It's sort of like that story during the Second World War in boot camp when the soldiers were being trained to become soldiers. And there was one man who went around picking up pieces of paper off the ground and saying, "This isn't it, this isn't it." And he didn't have any other conversation. He kept saying, "This isn't it." Finally, they recommended that he go to the camp psychiatrist. And in the psychiatrist's office, he picked up papers off the desk. "No, this isn't it. This isn't it." Finally, the psychiatrist, who wasn't able to get anything else out of him, recommended him for a medical discharge. As soon as he received that discharge, he said, "This is it!" And he ran out of the camp. Well, this is what I was doing. I was saying, "This isn't it, this isn't it, this isn't it." And I tried the arts. And I tried music. I played the piano for hours a day. I never thought of myself as a composer. Would you like to hear the first song I ever composed? I was 6 years old and I dreamed it. But there were three little ducks in sailor suits. And they were sort of dancing like this. And singing, "It's time to go to school, it's time to go to school, it's time to go right now." And so that was my first composition. And but I didn't think of myself as a composer. I never really, that was my first and last one for quite a few years. But I tried painting, I tried the arts of all kinds. Literature, writing, had somehow come very naturally to me. I suppose I must have been a writer in another life, because when I was 7 years old, I remember my parents were saying that in an essay I had written for school, I used the word "and" too much. You know, children will say "and," I went there, "and," I did "and" this. So they said that you shouldn't use as many "ands." And I knew they were right. I had no doubt about it. It's not that I challenged them or anything, but I was amazed at my own reaction, which I didn't express, which was, who is anyone to tell me how to write? Obviously, I think that means I must have written something or other in other lives. And then when I was 9, I was writing dialogue, not stories or anything. All I had read was stories, but somehow I wrote dialogue. And I've often thought that I probably was not only a writer, but a playwright. And so I developed the thought that I would become a playwright. But the problem was that I didn't want to write just ordinary stories. I wanted something that would help people to know the truth. And one day I woke up and realized, I don't know the truth. What am I doing then? I'm only flooding the world with my ignorance. And so I decided I would give up writing. And I didn't know what to do, because every single avenue that I took up that was according to my own particular talents. I'm a rotten carpenter. I'm no good as a gardener. There are lots of things I'm not good at, but a few things I can do. And none of them was leading me to truth. And I didn't know what to do about this. And so I decided, well, I'm not going to flood the world with my ignorance. I will not be a playwright. So I gave that up. I saw that every single path that I took led to the inevitable question of God. And finally I remember thinking, then there has to be God as the solution to everything. But I had rejected God. I remember a long walk that I took out into the evening outside Charleston, South Carolina. And I asked myself the question, if there's a God, what must he be? And I thought, well, he certainly isn't a policeman or a judge or somebody waiting to clap me into prison for eternity for making some little blunder. And I thought, what has he be? Well, what makes me, what gives me the power to ask such a question? A robot, if my brain is only, if consciousness is only produced in my brain, then that would mean that everything I do is somehow conditioned response. And a robot can be conditioned possibly to eat and to select food. But a robot couldn't possibly be conditioned to ask a question like this one. A robot, in fact, couldn't be conditioned to feel anything. He might eat food, but he could enjoy the taste. People nowadays who talk in terms of computer rights, that someday they'll become intelligent enough to be able to think and everything, that's not enough. You need feeling. And it does not come from sophisticated computer technology. A worm is conscious. A worm has enough feeling and self-awareness to want to wriggle away if you prick it with a pin. So this feeling is really the reality of consciousness. Reality, consciousness is not rational. Consciousness is feeling. And I have since learned that the nature of God is Satchidananda. The nature of God is ever-existing, ever-conscious bliss. And Master added to that ever-new bliss. And that may be an aspect I'll have time to get into. But it's a very important point that ever new means that every one of us experiences bliss in a different way. Every one of us seeks bliss in a different way. It's an incredible reality. Anyway, to come back to this, I thought, well, God has to be consciousness. I didn't know what that consciousness would signify, but I felt that then that has to be the explanation for my consciousness. I have to be conscious because I'm expressing his consciousness. Therefore, the goal of life has to be to seek God. Because the more conscious I am, the more aware I am. The less conscious, for example, after drinking, the less aware I am. And the goal of life then must be to seek God. And I remember coming back that evening to the apartment I was living in with four other young men. And they were sort of joking and being the usual way young men are. And I just thought, why bother with such yapping puppies? There's something serious in life. Don't they know that the goal of life is to seek God? And I vowed that night I would devote my life to seeking God. Nothing else mattered. And I didn't know how to seek God. I didn't even know that anybody had ever wanted to find God. I didn't know anything about the lives of saints. I'd heard the word. But I thought a saint was probably somebody who smiled at little old ladies and helped them across the street. But I didn't know that they were really seeking God. Yet the thought of seeking God had never occurred to me. And so I remember thinking, I was bound and determined to seek God, but finally another alternative popped in my mind. I said, maybe I'm going crazy. Maybe what I need is to get out in the country, feel nature, feel the simplicity of and the beauties of nature, and I'll find that peace of mind that at least that I desperately want. And so I went up. My parents lived in Scarsdale. My father had been sent to Egypt as an oil geologist, and my mother was preparing to go be with him. And I went upstate New York to a little place called Indian Lake, and I thought, here I'll find that simplicity I'm looking for. Well, first of all, the people were absolute dopes. I have to say it. They were not the kind of people who would give me anything. But I found that I myself, going out into the country, seeing the dewdrop on a pine leaf, let's say, and mentally I'd say, that's beautiful. But I can't feel it. I was like a motor working on one cylinder. And I thought, there's got to be something in me that I must change. And I realized the country's not going to change me. It's in myself I have to change. So I came back to this need for God. And my mother, first of all, down in Charleston, somebody had mentioned the name, the Bhagavad Gita. And I suppose from some other incarnations or something, that name rang in my mind, so I couldn't forget it. But I had no idea what it was. And the day I put Mother on the ship to go join Dad in Egypt, I went uptown to Doubleday Duran. That was the name of the store in those days. Now I think it's Doubleday, I'm not sure. And I found there a section on Hindu philosophy. Well, I forgot to tell you that in my mother's library, I had seen several books. One was the Bible. The other was the Short World Bible. And so the Bible, which also I hadn't bothered to read, I made the mistake of beginning at the wrong end. And it's just impossible to understand deep meaning in, and so-and-so lived to be 800 years, and he begat Moab or somebody, and he died. And I thought, what is the meaning of this? So I thought, well, it may all be very deep and wonderful, but I just can't understand it. So then I read this book on the Short World Bible, and it had excerpts from the different religions, and many were poetic and beautiful. But when I came upon the Indian teachings, I was absolutely thrilled. And in there, it said that Krishna taught Arjuna, if you want to find me, go to a solitary place and meditate on me. And I thought, that's what I'll do with my life. I didn't know about going to India. I never thought of going to India. But I thought maybe if I live in the Brazilian forests, the jungles there, that I'll be able to live very simply. Things are cheap there. And I'll be a hermit for the rest of my life. And if I find anything worthwhile, little peace of mind even, I will want to share it with other people. I don't want it just for me. And yet I don't know what I'd have done if I'd followed that destiny. I had the thought of working on a ship. I even got my merchant marine card. And I thought that working on a ship, I wouldn't be able to spend my money. I'd have a good income. And when I'd saved enough, I would go to Brazil and go out into the jungle and just live as a hermit. Well, thank God that I didn't do that. I wouldn't have known where to begin in my inner search. So the day I met, I put my mother on the ship. I went up into Doubleday, Duran, and I went into a section where there were the books on the Hindu religion. And I found the Bhagavad Gita there. And I remembered the name, so I bought that. And another book I saw there was Autobiography of a Yogi. And the face on that cover deeply attracted me. And I was drawn to buying it, but I thought, oh, I bought too many books. And then I found something else. It said, dedicated to Luther Burbank, an American saint. And I thought, well, that's preposterous. No American could be a saint. And so I put that book aside, and I bought the Bhagavad Gita, and I went home and read it in a day. It's a very short book. But I was thrilled with the teaching. And I went up to New York after I finished reading the Gita, and I was walking down 7th Avenue toward a subway to go down to Bowling Green to see if a ship had come in that I could ship out on, when the thought came very strongly to my mind, but what about Autobiography of a Yogi? And I said, oh, you're too intellectual, you're doing too much reading, and you must stop spending your money in any way, an American saint. Ha! Huh. So I was crossing, going to the curb to cross the street and get into the subway when an actual force turned me left toward 5th Avenue and that bookstore. And I thought, I didn't make this decision. Someone made it for me. And I became quite excited. So I was walking toward 5th Avenue. I went into that shop. And the first thing I did was buy that book. And I was clutching it to my heart because I was so attracted to the face of Yogananda that he was already dear to me, already my own. And then a friend from high school met me. And he started talking about the wonderful future he was contemplating in advertising, and how he'd have a home in Scarsdale and have a wife and children, and he'd invite us there and me there. And the more he talked, the more I clutched this book to me, because it was such a contrast to what he was talking about. And I went home and I read that book, sleeping, waking. I hardly slept for 3 days. I was reading that book between tears of laughter and tears of even greater joy. And he said there that he was a vegetarian. I'd never even thought you could live without eating meat. But as soon as I read that, I gave up eating meat. And the first evening, some friends of mine who wanted to sort of help take care of me because my mother had left. So they invited me to dinner. And they served chicken a la king. Well, I thought, I can handle this. So I pushed the chicken to one side and just ate the meat and the vegetables. And the next day, while I was reading Autobiography, the next day, another friend of mine invited me and they served hamburgers. So I just wouldn't eat it. Anyway, I decided after reading that book, I have to go to see him. So there I was in New York, 3,000 miles from Los Angeles. But I took the next bus across the country. And as I was going across the country, my mind was fixed on two thoughts. One, that I would meet him, I would accept him as my guru, and I hoped he would accept me. And I thought, if I find something worthwhile, I want to change the whole world. Everybody should know these teachings. So I had this deep longing to help everybody. And the day I met him, it was in the Hollywood Church, as I said. And the secretary there, Mary Hammond, her name was, said to me, "Oh, I'm sorry, you couldn't possibly see him today. I came there after the service when he was seeing a few appointments that he had." And I had always had this thought that if I really want something, I would get it. And I had found this to be amazingly valid in my life. I won't go into all of that, but it's a very interesting philosophy in itself, because I found it, as I said, to be true. Anyway, I thought, everything I've ever wanted, I've been able to get. But this is the one thing, the only thing, that really matters to me, and I'm being denied it. And I said, "How long will it take to see him?" She said, "Well, his appointments are booked for the next 2.5 months. And I thought, this is just not possible. But after a few minutes, I finally thought, well, maybe I'm not ready. I guess I needed that thought, because I'd been too confident. I needed to think I'm not ready. I needed to be humble. And so I thought, well, then I will go into the hills near here and rent a house and get a job and come on Sundays and wait till he will see me. But I'm bound and determined not to let anything stand in my way of meeting him. And so I had reached the door. I had just gone out the door when Mary Hammond came up behind me and said, "Since you've come from such a distance, I'll ask him if he'll see you now, because his appointments are finished." So she went in to him and came out and said that he will see you now. So I went in and saw him. The first words I said to him were, "I want to be your disciple." And I couldn't explain anything. People have asked me, "What was your impression of him?" I couldn't have an impression. I already knew. And I was only mentally thinking desperately. I said, "You've got to accept me." I said, "I'd only cry if I said it. But you just got to." And he, that very day, accepted me. And he gave me his unconditional love. And he asked me to give him mine. And then he asked me to give my unconditional obedience. Well, desperate as I was to be accepted, I had to be honest. So I said to him, "Sir, what if I find you someday, what if I think you someday to be wrong?" And he said, "I will never tell you anything or ask anything of you that God himself does not tell me to ask." So under those circumstances, I gave him my unconditional obedience. Then he had me kneel in front of him, and he had me take the vows of discipleship and of monkhood. Then he put his hand on my chest like this. It vibrated like for 2 minutes. And I thought, I'm so dense I can't feel anything. But I found afterwards my life was changed. And I went that same day. I don't know of any other case where he accepted anybody so fast. But he said to me at the beginning of our interview that I'm seeing you not because you've come from such a distance, but because Divine Mother told me to. And Divine Mother was the word he constantly referred to when talking with me specifically, although often in his own life. And an interesting sidelight on all of this is that he told us, and I'm going to take a break from my theme here, but he told us something that to me was shocking. He said he had been William the Conqueror. I had been raised in the English tradition, and I'd always thought of William the Conqueror as one of history's great villains. And now suddenly I found that he was my own guru. Well, you can imagine this was a bit of a mental adjustment. And so, in fact, I had Catherine Van Houten, whom I've given now the name Carnaby, to study his life. And she found in the process that William was in fact a great soul. In the Bhagavad Gita it says, may I have a Kleenex? In the Bhagavad Gita it says that when darkness increases and virtue declines, you can come, okay. When virtue increases and darkness increases and virtue declines, I incarnate myself on earth as an avatar. An avatar is a liberated soul who has come back into a physical body. And an avatar would be somebody like Jesus, like Krishna, like Buddha. Not an ordinary liberated soul even, but one who, after achieving liberation, comes down as a complete manifestation of God. This is the meaning of avatar. And as I'll read to you later on, somebody said I was an avatar. And I have to explain that that meaning isn't quite the same as what Master told me. Not quite. Anyway, William, not only, you see, an avatar has a different job from that of a saint. A saint usually needs to protect his humility, needs to be especially careful not to hurt people and so on, and not to let his ego intrude. An avatar doesn't bother with that stuff. His job is to come in with a broom. And so William had to sweep the land clear and he was there to create a new civilization. But several things come out. One is that his close friends were all spiritual people, all saints. And 430 years after his death, his body was exhumed and found to be incorrupt. So that's not what people would normally think of William the Conqueror. But he was a great master. And I'm not here to say that from my intuition or anything, but he had to be to do what he did. And after Master's passing, the thought had come to me very strongly that I was his son, Henry. He had two older sons who were apparently sort of like a pause between the time of William and the time his message, his mission, was finished. And so those two older sons didn't understand his mission at all. But Henry did. And when Henry became king, he finished that mission. And this book, Catherine Kairavi's, is really interesting. It's just come out in book form, and I do recommend that you read it because it teaches so many things and is so fascinating. It's called Two Souls, Four Lives. Anyway, I believe that I was Henry. And so it's been my job for other incarnations also. Master told us that he had also been a king in Sweden. And one of our members in Italy did research and found that the person most likely to have been that king was Ferdinand III. And his heir was Alfonso X. And an interesting thing is that Alfonso, and this is where I left what I was saying. Alfonso wrote 400 and something over 400 canticles to the Divine Mother. So evidently that was that devotion to God, as the Divine Mother seems to be something special with me. I'll tell you, however, a very interesting story. When I lecture, I often deviate, so please forgive me. This deviation will be that many years later I felt the Divine Mother had inspired me to go back to India. I hadn't been back there. And I had the money, about $2,000. It was enough to get me there and back and to be there for about 2 months. And just a week or 2 weeks before I was to leave, the car I had threw a rod and I realized I had to get a new car. So the debate was, do I go to India or do I get a new car? It was either one or the other. And so I remember sitting in a cafe. There was no church I could go to and meditate in. But I went to a cafe and discussed this thing with my friends. And we just didn't know what to do. I felt no guidance. But I finally said, Divine Mother, I don't know what you want. But my common sense tells me that when I come back, which I must, I'll need a car living up there in the mountains as I do. So if I get a good used car, you're just going to have to reimburse me. That's the way I prayed. And so I bought the car Friday night, and I spent $1,100 on it. The next Monday morning, I received in the mail a check from somebody I'd never heard of, and it contained a check. The check was written for $1,000. But the interesting thing, too, was that in the letter accompanying it, it said, use this as Divine Mother wants you to. Now, how many people in America think of God as the Divine Mother? I have to say, very few. But this letter said that specifically. And, of course, that made it possible for me to go to India and come back. I have seen time and again in my life that she does answer prayers. She does love us. She does want our welfare. And so in my crossing the country and meeting Master, he said that I will only ask of you what Divine Mother tells me. He said, I'm only seeing you because Divine Mother told me to. And these thoughts resonated deeply with me. And he had me come that day to live at Mount Washington. I don't know of another case where anybody has been, any courtship of him as a guru has been so rapid. But I lived there for the rest of his life. And I'd like to read a few things in this paper, this booklet that I've written, and I suppose some of you at least have read this book. It's so-called Rescuing Yogananda. Part of my reason for being down here in Los Angeles is that I am appalled at how they have made Master seem so much less than he really was. And many people have gotten the impression that he was a stern disciplinarian and harsh in his treatment of people. And I want people to understand, and this is probably the main reason I'm here, although not the only one, how he was the most lovable human being I've ever met. He was very sweet. Yes, he was strong, but he had to be. He was our teacher. But he was so full of love and kindness and forgiveness. And sometimes I would feel that love washing over me like a tide. I would sit in his presence. He'd be talking about something completely mundane, about work that needed doing. I would feel these waves of bliss pouring over me. That's the Yogananda I want people to know. And I feel that Yogananda is being betrayed. So when I speak of rescuing Yogananda, this book is just, coming out, but it'll come out. I think you'll have a copy here. But it's also going to come out in book form very soon, and you can order it. I think it's an important book. It is not an easy book to write or to read. It's very accusatory in certain ways, and I'm sorry for that. I've never wanted to accuse anyone. In my heart, I have nothing against anyone. But these were things that had to be said if the kind of changes needed were there. It's sort of like Henry. His older brother, Robert Curthose, kept trying to attack him. And finally, and he was such a hopeless Duke of Normandy, finally Henry had to come in and take Normandy from him. And Robert Curthose, some historians say he was endurance vile. From then on, he wasn't. He was treated like a guest. He was a guest at many banquets, and he was completely free, except he could not leave his prison. Henry would not allow him to continue to do damage because he was destroying Normandy. Now, in that spirit, I have written this book. Not that I want to take over anything, but I desperately want to see Master shown and given to the world as an avatar of love and bliss, and as the wonderful, beautiful, dear person he really was. So this book will be a shocker. I don't know what kind of response it's going to get, but I wrote it from my heart with no malice to anybody, but rather with the hope of improving things. And one thing that I hope will come from this book is to help all organizations, if they can become, some people who have read this book say, well, that's the way organizations are. But if they can be worse, they can surely be better also. At Ananda, we have two principles that have kept Ananda on track. Members of Ananda are kind. Members of Ananda are forgiving. Members of Ananda are cooperative with one another and helpful to one another and supportive of one another. And the two rules we follow above all are people are more important than things. And that means, for example, that if there's a very important job that's needed and there's no one available to do it who will be helped in doing that job, we will delay doing the job rather than inflict that work on somebody. We will even completely abandon the project if nobody can be found who will be helped in doing it. So people to us, and I have rigidly followed this principle. I've been very strict with myself because I have to be. But indeed, for example, many years ago when I was building Ananda and I was in great need of money, some young man came to me. He said, I've recently had an inheritance, and I'd like to know whether you would advise me to join an Ananda, in which case I would give my inheritance to Ananda, or whether I should go to India. And I asked him how much this inheritance was, not because I was thinking in terms of what I could get out of it, but rather of whether he had enough money to go to India. So he answered 200,000, which in 1969 was the equivalent of about $1 million. That would have been enough to put Ananda well on the road to success. I wasn't even tempted. I said, I think you should go to India. I never heard from him again. I don't care. But I've been very rigid about this principle. I'm not rigid about most things, but when it comes to truth, I am rigid. And another principle in this that we follow is an ancient Indian saying, Yada Dharma Satajaya. Where there is dharma, or right action, there is victory, success, happiness, everything. So we have always rigidly tried to be dharmic. When SRF sued us in 1990, I think they spent some $50 million, had to have spent that. They hired the third largest law firm in the world, Gibson, Dunn and Crutcher, which at that time was that size. We hired a lone practitioner without a secretary, not because he was cheap, but because he was dharmic. And all the way through, they told lie after lie. They even said, and I've said this in this book, that Yogananda wrote the autobiography of a yogi as a work for hire, or that it was written by a committee. All of these to protect the copyright that they owned. Well, that's not a dharmic way to behave. And as a result of this, they lost that copyright. And now we've been able to print the original edition. And you'll see the kind of changes they've made in that edition since his death. It's really appalling. One of the most terrible things they did was take out one quarter of the poem Samadhi, including the lines, by deeper, longer thirsty guru-given meditation comes the celestial samadhi. These are things I must correct. I'm the only person in the world who could correct them. I'm the only person in the world who knows the story behind the story. So this is why I've written this book. But let me read from this book now what happened with me after I met Master. First of all, a year later after I met him, he put me in charge of the other monks. He worked with me in developing rules for our way of life, to which he himself had not paid much attention over the years. Allowed me to accept new monks, and finally worked closely with me on various aspects of our way of life. He also had me help him with editing his books. I remained in charge of the monks until my unexpected and, to me, tragic dismissal from his organization in July 1962. B. I am, as I said, one of the last of his still living disciples. Apart from one teacher who is publicly known, but who teaches primarily his own teachings, that's Roy Davis, rather than his gurus, I am also the only still living disciple appointed by the Master to speak publicly on his behalf. C. No. It may also be of interest to know that I was still only 22 when he first had me lecture on his behalf. It was an occasion when he had been expected to appear himself. Saturday morning, I was asked to lead the Sunday service in San Diego on his behalf, and afterwards to initiate someone into Kriya. I had been with him only 8 months. This dramatic story is told in my book, The New Path. See, after Master passed away, I served him in many new ways. I reorganized the correspondence department and, in the process, found it necessary to reorganize several other departments in the main office. Although my work in these matters ended up being largely abandoned, my efforts took me a year and a half of hard work. I recreated the center department, which served SRF centers and meditation groups throughout the world. I traveled widely, lecturing in several countries on SRF's behalf. I created a lay disciple order. I was the minister of our Hollywood church from 1955 to 58, when I was sent to India. I continued as the head monk and wrote the rules for our order, both monks and nuns. I created service readings for our centers everywhere. The readings contained suggestions merely for ideas the leaders might convey in their talks. I didn't tell them what to say, but I did establish a topic for each week of the year to be used universally in all our churches and centers. This must somehow have been during Master's lifetime, though I don't clearly remember how it could have been. Still, I do remember that Master himself expressed pleasure over this decision. I wrote notes for the monks to help me give classes in discipleship. These notes were later used by Sister Shraddha in classes she gave for the nuns. Later they became known as Sister Shraddha's notes. Well, what did it matter? God, after all, is the real doer. In India, I rearranged the entire course of SRF lessons, a labor that took me a year and a half. This work was, in addition to what I say elsewhere, about what I did my first two years in India. This work, I should add, was never accepted in America and was finally thrown out in India after my dismissal. My suggestions for service readings became hardened in time so that they had to be read out verbatim, but that was never what I did. Since my dismissal from SRF, I've sometimes asked myself whether their action against me was not based on pure jealousy. I accomplished so much and they, by comparison, so little, that jealousy would have been a perfectly normal human reaction. In fact, at the 1962 meeting in New York that I had with Daya and Tara, when I was dismissed, one thing Tara said with a great sigh of relief was, "Never again will you have to listen to all the ideas hatched in that fertile brain of yours." Well, to continue, I also recorded for SRF two albums of Master's chants. I'd studied singing when I was younger, and I've always had what I suppose is a good voice. That was why I was chosen to make this recording. I also wrote articles for the SRF magazine, and in the later ones was selected to pose for the Hatha Yoga articles. In 1960, I was made a member of the board of directors and was also appointed to the vice presidency of SRF. Thus, it may be seen clearly that I was one of Paramahansa Yogananda's foremost disciples. My service to him since his passing, I've written and published some 140 books, composed over 400 pieces of music, created 8 communities with a total residency of some 1,000 persons, gives me the right to claim a certain spiritual closeness to him, for it could only be by his power that I have achieved so much. I didn't do it myself. He did it through me. Now, these things I'm saying as a sort of expression of gratitude, because this is my birthday of my anniversary, my meeting with him. And so I say these things looking back and to think, I have lived my life for him. Kriyananda doesn't exist. I've done nothing in all my life for myself. I haven't wanted anything for myself. People, when I was young, many people thought I'd be become a foremost playwright. I didn't want it for fame. And when I found that I didn't know the truth, why bother with playwriting? When I was learning singing at the age of 18, my singing teacher said, she was 75 at the time. She said, "I'm only living for one thing, and that's to see you become a great singer." I never went back to her. I didn't want to be known for anything particular. I don't want to be known. I'd like to be a voice in the back, but I know I can't be. And I know Master himself scolded me for trying to back off when I had a work to do. He told me many times, as I've written in this book here, he said, "You have a great work to do." And I've done my best to do that work for him, not for me. I remember one time he said to me, we were alone at the desert retreat in 29 Palms, and he said to me, "Of all of the men, apart from St. Lynn," that's what he called Rajaji then, "apart from St. Lynn, every man has disappointed me, and you mustn't disappoint me." And he spoke with great power. And I knew that he wanted me to somehow serve his work in an important way. I'm in Los Angeles to try to bring that about. And I'm here to try to correct things, too. And if I seem presumptuous or wrong, I'm very sorry. But I don't feel that I have an alternative. If I don't do it, I will be shirking my duty. And when you see a duty and ignore it, you're guilty of the sin of omission. In this case, omitting to defend the truth as you know you can. So I ask the world to forgive me. I say in my book that I have nothing against Daya. I have nothing against any of them. But I do hope that what I've written about her here will not hurt her, but help her soul evolution. I want to help everybody, including the people I criticize. But my life has been and had only one focus, and that is to serve Master, to get his message known. I think he saw that I, like Henry, understood his full mission and understood that it was what it is, a mission to change the world, to change civilization. He did not come to start a monastery. He didn't come to make Mount Washington beautiful. He came like William to change all of civilization. And my job in this life is to help people to understand that truth. So today is a very important day in my life. Interestingly enough, two psychics have spoken to me. I should say one psychic and another. And the first one said to me, until now, your services to the world has been blocked, but now, from now on, things will flourish. I think that will prove to be true. But there's also a very interesting thing here of a reading I got in India just 2 days before I left for Italy this year in it's a Agastya reading in a suburb of New Delhi called Gurgaon. And here they had a branch of an Agastya was an ancient saint. He lived 5,000 years ago. This reading is said to be that. Master mentions him in Autobiography of a Yogi. He says, speaks about him as being Amar, which means deathless, and like Babaji. And he said there are rumors of his living still, but he didn't say more in the book. Anyway, these were supposed to have been written by him and to have been copied out 400 years ago into what you might call, in quotes, modern Tamil. And you might like to hear that too. And Davey, you might like to come up and see if I can. Oh, I've got it here. I do have it. Never mind. Several people asked me to read this or asked me to help them know it. So I thought, well, let me add this to it, because he too said that until now, Master said to me, he often said to me, you have a great work to do and so on. But you know, we all have incarnations of many faults. And he said to me, my supreme fault in the past was doubt. And you know, when you break a bone and the bone heals, that bone, the new bone, is stronger than the bone around it. So it happens in our reincarnations that our faults eventually become our greatest strength. So it would be natural that my greatest strength would be my faith. I have deep faith now. But apparently in the past I didn't. Master told me personally, you were eaten up with doubts. And for many incarnations I suffered because of this. He quoted to me something from the Bhagavad Gita, which says, Arjuna the doubter is the most miserable of mortals. And I think it was that fact that now that I really knew what I wanted and why I wanted it, that I felt such an intense desire to help people. I think doctors, for example, want to be doctors because they've suffered in the past in their health. Psychiatrists have suffered because they were crazy. Every work that people do is often influenced by their experiences in the past. My experience was suffering due to doubts. But on the other hand, it proved to be a great blessing. And so it is that any fault that you have, it will be a blessing to you. Don't regret it. Just remember what Master said. A saint is a sinner who never gave up. It's like back when I was 21 and I decided I wanted to be a hermit. And I thought, well, if I'm a hermit, I won't be able to smoke. And I like smoking. So I'll have to give up smoking. And like what Mark Twain said, I find smoking the easiest thing in the world to give up. I've done it 1,000 times. Well, I would, at lunchtime with my coffee, I would think how nice that cigarette tasted with coffee, and I'd go back to it. But the very important point that is well worth sharing with everybody is that every time I failed, I never said, I failed. I always said, I haven't yet succeeded. Remember, when you work on any fault, just if you fail, I haven't yet succeeded. Never say I've failed. Never call yourself a sinner. Master said calling yourself a sinner is the greatest sin of all. Remember, you are a child of God. Remember, you have the potential to become perfect in God, and always live with the thought of that potential. That isn't ego. That's getting rid of ego. Perfection comes only when you've gotten rid of this thought that I do anything. He does it all. And so, finally, after a year, I remember I said to one of my roommates, I've given up smoking. And he chuckled. He said, oh, I've heard that one before. Ha, ha, ha. And I said, no, I mean it. And I had lost all desire. Since then, I've never had another desire. You know, when you have a fault and you finally overcome it, you wonder what all the excitement was. It leaves you completely. It isn't as if you had to battle the temptation anymore. It doesn't mean anything to you. And so you will see that no matter what you think you are now, you are not that. And you must and will become perfect. That is your destiny. You have no choice. Sooner or later, you've come from God. Sooner or later, you have to return to Him. And so whoever you think you are, whether your habits are smoking or anything, that is not who you are. And you will someday have to leave it. So I say, why not now? Why waste time? Eventually, why not now? And so with this teaching of masters, I have found that it is the most dynamic teaching that has come into this world for a long time. His mission here was much greater than what is being said now, that he came to found a monastery. That's laughable when you realize what he did really come to do. He told me not only that you have a great work to do, but he told me the work specifically. He told me your work is writing, editing, lecturing. I said to him, sir, haven't you already written all the books that are needed? And he said, don't say that. Much more is needed. He already had me editing with him. I helped him with editing the Bhagavad Gita and the Bible and the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam. And of course, lecturing he already had me doing from when I was still 22, and gave that lecture in San Diego. But when, just in 2005, I had always grieved because he had told me that his Gita and commentaries were the greatest ever, and they really are. I said to him when I was working with him on the Gita, I said, sir, this is the greatest book I've ever read. And he said, that came because it came from God. He said, I didn't write it myself. I tuned into Vedabhyasa and let him write it through me. Masters can talk like this. It seems incredible that a master who lived thousands of years ago in India should dictate a work through him. But really, that's how it was. I was with Master while he was writing this book. And he would just sit back and close his eyes and look up here and dictate. So anyway, what SRF published, I did not like. They did research for it to find certain things. I thought, why do research on this great book? It takes away, it doesn't add anything. But it's cumbersomely edited. Some of the truths are not stated correctly. It says, for example, in that edition that when you attain samadhi, you're free. That's not true. Master himself told me that there are two stages of samadhi, and when you've attained sabhikalpa, you're not free. You have to attain nirvikalpa samadhi. Only then will you be free. He said to me, only after you've attained nirvikalpa samadhi can you say to yourself, now I am free. Until then, it's possible to fall. And he gave me some examples of people who had attained sabhikalpa and fallen from that state. I have some reason to believe that maybe I did that, but fell from it. But these things happen. So that's a wrong teaching to say that you attain that after you've reached samadhi. It has to be the higher of two samadhis. I was not pleased with that. And so I remember saying to Master in a dream, Master, I wish I could get my hands on that manuscript. because I want to do the work. You told me to do the work, but it's locked up in their archives. And he said to me in the dream, don't overlook the possibility of a skylight. And when I was in India in 2005, I thought it would be wonderful to write this. I don't know if I ever will, but I have to. And so I thought, well, let me at least try to write what I do remember. And all of a sudden, as I started to write, I suddenly remembered every single sloka, every single stanza in that entire 7-sloka scripture. Not word for word, but concept for concept. It just flowed out of me. And what I've written is what he wrote. I didn't write it. But it was just amazing to me that I wrote this entire 600-page book in just under 2 months. It's that kind of thing doesn't happen without some sort of miracle involved. But all my life I have dedicated to doing what I can to make his truth known. And I have all the books I have written, each one addresses a different aspect of those teachings which he brought to the whole world, which will change the world. I've written books on so many different subjects: marriage, business, success, education of children. I can't name them all, 140 books. But each one of them helps to bring out a different aspect of his teachings and to show a way for us to create a new civilization. This is what is needed today. Master often talked about the coming future. He said that we're coming to a time of very great depression. He said it would be far worse than the 1930s. He said that there would be suffering everywhere. I know that one of these readings I got in India from the Bhrigu Sangita, which some of you know about, that in the future when there will be weeping in every home, he will be an influence for reassuring people and giving them faith. But I think that period is on us now. I think we're on the edge of a huge depression. And what Master gave as a way out of that suffering that must come. Just think of people living in the inner cities. How will food come to them? People on the outside of the cities will grab those trucks. You know, just a year ago or so, a truck came into the inner city of Detroit. It had to be protected by two people with two shotguns or rifles or something. But food, to bring food into the inner cities when people are hungry in the outer cities, it's not going to be easy. Los Angeles will surely suffer. We must be prepared for these things because I think they are inevitable. The avarice that our country has shown has to bring us to that point. But Master said, one thing you ought to do, and he said it with great fervor, I plead with you, get land in the country. Live with a few friends in the country. Grow your own food. Learn to live simply and practice high ideals. Then you will be able to eat at least. You won't be able to have all the things you want, all the luxuries you want. No one will have those. But he talked about this so fervently. There was one time, and this I mention in this book, The Rescuing Yogananda, there was one time when he was invited to a garden party in Beverly Hills. It's on the estate of a Mrs. Myers, a wealthy woman, and about 800 people came. Many of them were Hollywood celebrities and so on. And at the end of this garden party, she got up and asked Master to say a few words. Well, you can imagine what a person, a principal guest at a garden party in Beverly Hills, is likely to say. Gracious thanks to the guests and to the hostess. Gracious a few words of philosophy that would be painless, but helpful and inspiring. Wow, that talk. I tell you, it was the most powerful talk I have ever heard in my life. This day!
And he continued in that vein, saying thousands of Jews must go north, south, east, everywhere, spreading this message of World Brotherhood colonies, of getting people to get land in the country and live simply and learn how to live plainly with high ideals. And he said, this is the answer to the depression. If you have those things, you will not suffer. And I asked Diamata in 1958, when are we going to start these communities? Her answer was, frankly, I'm not interested. In fact, they even took out that as one of Master's main ideals. But all the time I was with him, which is 3.5 years, not very long, but longer than the disciples of Jesus Christ were with him, so you can't say it was nothing. And I was very close to him. He spent many hours talking to me personally about his teachings, about his wishes for the work, about all sorts of things, funny and serious. I remember one funny story he told me. It was a story about Ranchi. There were some dogs there. I think he said greyhounds, but I'm not absolutely certain. And he was chasing them. And he was a very fast runner when he was young. He caught these dogs and put them into a gunny sack and took the dogs far away from the school and let them out there. And he was telling it with such exuberance, and I couldn't understand part of what he was saying because his Bengali accent became so strong at that point. But I just couldn't help, because of his own enthusiasm, laughing exuberantly with him. And I was with Master and with Tara, Lori Pratt, who was his chief editor. And she was sitting there, not a smile, just, well, well, gazing into the middle distance. Well, well, think of that. And this, I don't know, but I must say, in many ways, they have tried to misrepresent him. They've tried to show him as a man of no sense of humor. They've tried to cut out things that make him seem human. And he was human. But he didn't have any human faults. He had human virtues. But for example, at his last birthday, Dr. Lewis said to him, there was one candle on a birthday cake. Dr. Lewis said to him, do you think you can blow out that candle? Jokingly. We could joke with Master. The way they present him now, you don't get the idea that you dare tell a joke. And Master said, oh, I think there's a little breath left in my body. They put that in the recording, but they took out what came next. I just have to be careful I don't blow the cake away. Well, somebody thought, this sounds egotistical, so they removed it. That's the sort of thing I mean. They've cut out his sense of humor. They've cut out his humanity. And you get left with a person who seems stuffy and brutal, practically, in his impersonality. And it's not the Master I knew and lived with. So anyway, I want today to reinforce my reason for being here in Los Angeles. There's another reason I'm here, and that is that last year, having written many books, I suddenly got the inspiration to write films. I didn't know how to write films. I wanted to be a playwright. But the beauty about films is that they are, you can change the scene all the time. If you reach a part of the discussion where the conversation runs out, you just change the scene. A playwright has to keep the conversation interesting. So it's much easier to write a film. In fact, I wrote 2 films, each one in 1 week. One is The Wayshower, which tells the story of autobiography of a yogi with many stories that are not in the autobiography, because he didn't want to talk about himself, but I could. And this one begins, for example, with Jesus Christ in the Himalayas appearing. Master told us this is what happened. Jesus Christ appearing to Babaji and saying, what has happened to my religion? He said, they're doing good works, but they've forgotten the importance of inward communion with God. And so he said, let us send someone to the West to bring back my teaching again. And so what he brought was the second coming of Christ. Was he himself Jesus Christ? This I can't say. I did ask him once, and he said, what difference would it make? So I realized he didn't want to talk about it, and perhaps one shouldn't talk about it, but to friends like you, I think I can. I think he was. I worked on that book, Revelations of Christ, editing his words, and the power that I found in Jesus Christ, and also the sense of humor, if you can believe it. It's something I really feel when I read some of those stories there. When I visualize the story stripped of all the formal language and so on, I saw that he has a delightful sense of humor. But I realized also that his spirit and Yogananda's were very similar. And I suspect, going back over all of these things, I suspect it was Jesus Christ who became William the Conqueror. Master said that Jesus would certainly, a man of such compassion, would certainly have come back again and again into this world. Those are Master's words. And William the Conqueror gets my nomination. So also does Fernando III in Spain. I think that's who he was. He's come back in many, many bodies. And as he said now, I will come back in 200 years. And it'll be a time out for me. I'll go to the Himalayas and spend time meditating and then gather my close disciples. So many fascinating things. But this Agastya reading I found extremely interesting. And let me read it to you. It's a little long, and if you want to protest, say, please shut up. On April 30th, 2010, I went to a place in Gurgaon where I had an appointment to see a pundit somewhat similar to the Bhrigu pundits I'd met 50 years ago in Barnala and in Delhi, where the pundit himself visited from Hoshiarpur. I had gone to this Agastya pundit also the day before because I'd mentioned to Divya, an Indian friend, that I was going. She knew him and therefore took me to see him. On that day, however, nothing was found for me. Many people go. Dharmadas and Nirmala have gone. But nobody that I know has had a reading. So it's not everyone who gets one. Anyway, I thought, since he hadn't found anything for me, that I would cancel my appointment the next day. But two men who were friends of Dharmaraj had come over to take me to him. One of them telephoned the pundit, who said he had found something for me. So then I returned. We arrived there at 10:30 and were ushered into the pundit's interview room. Excuse me a moment. We're ushered into the interview room. I will give you a version of his reading, carefully edited and condensed, because the man speaks only Tamil, with perhaps a smattering of Hindi, but no English, and also because the reading was rather too fulsome in its praise. I should add that the pundit became quite excited about the reading. When I left, he, his wife, and the manager of the Agastya Center, a Mr. Rangaswamy, came out onto the street to wave goodbye to me as I left. They remained there while the car turned around and continued to wave and smile until our car had departed. His normal fee would have been ₹220,000, but for my reading was longer than most. His usual charge is only ₹5,000. My new friends had offered to pay for it, but the pundit wanted me to have it free. Later, word came to me that the pundit and his associates were exclaiming, "We've never had such a reading before." They wrote it all out on paper and wanted me to come over immediately to hear it read out so I could, as they put it, get the direct blessings of Shiva and Parvati. I answered that I was scheduled to give a satsang in honor of my birthday. The celebration was being held 2 or 3 weeks before my actual birthday for the reason that I'd have to be in India on the date itself. the 19th. They insisted it has to be read today only. This was already early in the evening, about 6:40, so I explained about the satsang and asked them please to come to my house to save time. They usually don't go, but they agreed, arriving at about 7:10. The satsang was to begin at 7:30, and it would take me about 20 minutes to reach the site where it was to be held. Needless to say, I was intensely embarrassed, but simply didn't know what to do. Haridas led everyone in chanting, which continued, happily, thank God, for the next hour and a half. The satsang on my arrival was very sweet. Dhammaraja was present informs me that as the reading commenced, there arose a sudden storm out of doors, with heavy rains, howling winds, several trees were knocked down. At one point a window behind my chair was blown open. I myself, being hard of hearing, was quite oblivious to most of this. But the rain evidently was very heavy, for when I emerged to go to the satsang, the storm had passed. It stopped at just when they finished the reading. And I remember being quite amazed to see the streets were heavily flooded. Coincidence? Anyway, to the reading. The pundit began with a few facts as verification that this was indeed my reading and no one else's. My parents are no longer living, it said, practically inevitable at my age. Their names were Ray and Gertrude. The first names they gave me were James Donald. I am their firstborn. I have one younger brother still alive. I was born on May 19, 1926, with Moon, according to Vedic astrology, in Cancer, into a socially respected Christian family across the sea. This person, the reading continued, is very intelligent, talented, very technically minded, and logical. The original states very technically thoughts, not very good English. Whatever he does from a sense of Dharma. That was the translation. He does from a sense of Dharma. The work he does is an act of worship. He is warm-hearted and generous and treats people with equal kindness of heart, for to him all people are one. They are children of God. He seeks impartially to uplift everybody. He has good guru bhakti, or devotion. His speech is sweet and his lectures are very magnetic. He has good attitudes and good habits, great clarity in his writing, and is pious. He respects points of view, religious or otherwise, even if they differ from his own. He will be drawn more and more into artistic channels. He did not complete his formal education. And then it suddenly shifts to the second person. Many people in many places accept your teaching, places and countries accept your teaching, which follows in line with the teachings and advice of your guru. You have founded and are the guide of many ashrams in many, many places. You maintain yourself on whatever money people give you. The reading continued. You have been born an avatar or incarnation of Shiva. Avatar literally means descent from above, and it could only have been in that sense that he was talking, because I certainly had my faults. He said avatar of Kali Yuga. The leaf from which he read has been established by carbon dating to be 400 years old. It seems very possible that the word Kali was inserted at that time. That I am doing my guru's work rather than my own became evident later when he said, your guru thinks through you. The leaves are said to have originated 5,000 years ago. I have long considered Yogananda to be the avatar for this new Dwapara Yuga. Since I am on his team, I can accept the above in this light. But it is true also that I have my own way of presenting my guru and his mission to the world. The reading was found by taking the print of my right thumb. Your right thumb, he said to me, is Oru Sutru Meru Rai Kai, phonetic. I don't know what that is. But the meaning is, as a mountain starts broad at the base, then rises to a peak. This is a very good indeed high impression. There are another three minute dots, invisible only through a magnifying glass, invisible to the naked eye, visible through a magnifying glass, the nature of which is very fortunate and an indication of Shiva's blessings. He spoke of a large following in many countries, ashrams, good public service, educational institutions, medical services. It's continuing along these lines at some length. He also spoke of music composed and recorded, dramas, film script writing, etc. Many books. He also said my books would be placed in museums. Whatever aspirations you have, you will fulfill. Some wrong actions of the past have impeded your success until now and have prevented you from attaining the fulfillment and recognition you deserved. Past doubts were what hindered you from flowering into full charity, a clarity of mind. The planetary positions, also were not wholly auspicious. From now on, people will come to know from you many truths and will gain many insights. There have been conspiracies against you, false charges leveled against you, health problems, medical treatments, losses, good efforts destroyed, etc. Regarding good efforts destroyed, consider the Delhi project. When I won the consent of Prime Minister Nehru himself to build on 25 acres of the Green Belt, and in fact, that was quite a miracle, because 1,700 societies had tried to get land there. All of them had been turned down. But SRF adamantly refused to go through with the plan. And consider the whole year I spent in India from 58 to 59 regarding the SRF lessons, only to have my good work thrown out. These have been my tests. They can be mitigated by the following service. He wanted me to lay the cornerstone of a temple they are building in Kerala, which I'm told would not be only dedicated by me, but also to me, and several things that I cannot do because I had to come to Italy. However, they accepted that Dharmadas and Nirmala could go in my stead. Their travels will be paid for by the pundits, and they will arrive there on June 4th. So now you will have many achievements. From now on, you will understand the greatness of your incarnation. You know, Master always told me, you just have to accept that you have a job to do and don't keep putting yourself down. It's been my tendency. I know a friend of mine just told me, why do you have to keep putting yourself down? I do it automatically, but it's something we should, it doesn't mean anything. As Master said, I asked him once, would you like the monks to call me Walter as you do or Don? And he said, they should call you Reverend Walter. And I hastily changed the subject. And he said, it isn't that anybody is more important than any others, but in an army there have to be captains as well as privates, and you have to accept it. Well, I wouldn't accept it. There was one thing I'm afraid I didn't obey him in, and it has been a weakness of mine. I can't help it. Anyway, now I've got to learn to accept it. So now you will have many achievements. From now on, you will understand. When Jupiter transits from its present position in a few days, though by Sri Yukteswar's Ayanamsha, it came out on April 25, the day I lectured to that college in Pune, which I did, you are likely to come out with many achievements. Many changes will come now in your spiritual life also. It is true that I've been feeling increasingly blissful inwardly. You will possess the Shakti or power to realize people's inner aspirations. Your new ashram near Pune will be successful. Wherever you place your foot, that place will be blessed. You will do your guru's will and will be completely true to his wishes. You are likely to appear in the media and your physical appearance will become well known. Your teachings will also attract other spiritual leaders. The teachings will be new and different, and more people accept them. You will have wealth, but will not seek it, and will offer it in service to others. At the age of 86, you will become a true person, whatever that means. You have many siddhis, do many wonderful things, have deep meditations, teach the secrets of kundalini, more ashrams in many places. Your teachings will reach and uplift people on all social levels. Compared to the discourses of other spiritual leaders, yours will be outstanding. Some respiratory and heart problems, but with God's grace, they will soon be overcome. I do have trouble with my heart. From 87, you will continue to deepen people's understanding. High fame, crowned, honored, more awards. I'm omitting a great deal of hyperbole. Your inspirations will come out through dramas, cinemas, TV channels. The rulers of nations will invite you and honor you. You will receive many citations and awards. Well, these people in nations and so on, a very good friend of mine is somebody who held the position in India comparable to J. Edgar Hoover in America. 88, 89, intuitive powers to understand past, present, and future. With these powers, you will see the problems that lie in the future and will warn people. You will be like a medicine to people, just a touch or a glance, and their problems will be solved. You will need, however, to be cautious about your health and should go for periodic medical checkups. Step by step, you will recover your health. Age 90, my God, he's cursing. Age 90, you will stop writing. Your works will be perceived as grounded in the universe. I take that to mean grounded in truth. Your followers will obey you. All your aspirations will be realized. Whatever you say to people, they will accept. All the Shakti of God will be yours. The good you do will prove permanent. You will enjoy Amrita, I suppose he means bliss, and will glimpse God. Age 91, while worshipping God, you will have mukti in the samadhi state and will disappear. All your plans will have been fulfilled. 9 is your lucky number, and you should wear a yellow sapphire. So that's that reading. It's interesting. And the fact that that psychic in Mountain View also told me that now your life is going to change, that the blocks that have been there, which Agastya attributes to doubts, and which I know for a fact to be true, because Master himself told me, he said, that's finally over, and my life will change. I suspect this book that I've just written will be a bombshell and will cause that kind of change. Anyway, it's interesting, I think, to share these things with you, because I want to invite all of you to be a part of what we're doing. You know, when I was thrown out of SRF, I'm not complaining. I think it was the best thing that ever happened to me. But at the time, it was undoubtedly a great suffering, the biggest test I've ever had. But I wanted to continue serving Master. I couldn't serve him by doing nothing. So for years I tried to find ways of serving him that would not in any way conflict with what SRF was doing. And so I remember I was thrown out in 1962. 1964, I went to Yosemite and I saw a couple of young men just the day before I was to leave there. A couple of young men were sitting on the railing of a bridge playing a guitar and singing. And I felt in the mood to sing. I had a reasonably decent voice, and so I sang. I didn't want to sing a chant. I didn't want to sing a bhajan. I didn't want to sing one of the classical songs that I knew. And in fact, that's why I would never become a singer, because classical songs are just as dumb as any popular song. I mean, in Italian, it sounds great. Oh, cessate di piagarmi. Oh, lasciatemi morire. Sounds great in Italian. But what it really means is stop bugging me and let me die. What kind of a message is that? And so I couldn't do that. But I did think of Sweet Swing Low, Sweet Chariot, and I thought, well, that has some spiritual meaning. So I sang that to them, and they were excited, and they said, you've got to come to a party and sing for us there tonight. So I did, and I went, and I sang Swing Low, Sweet Chariot. And the next day, people all loved it. And the next day I thought, well, this is something I can do to serve Master that isn't at all conflicting with anything SRF does. And so I thought, but what am I going to sing? None of the songs I know have any meaning, and I want to spread Master's teachings. What kind of a service would it be to go around showing off my voice? And so I thought, well, maybe I can write my own music. All of a sudden, that thought came to me, and as I asked that question, all of a sudden a song came into my mind. And it was beautiful, words and music and everything. And I stopped at a milkshake stand and wrote it down on a paper napkin. And my brother had left a good Martin guitar at my parents' place. So he let me use it, gave it to me. So I bought Pete Singer's Guitar Singer's Folk Singer's Guitar Guide, teaching people how to play the guitar. I'd never tried before. And I practiced it and I began writing songs. None of the songs, people have tried to think what I went through when I wrote the song. None of them express what I went through. They express only feelings that I wanted to convey, truths that I wanted to convey. But anyway, I'd written a few, three I think, when somebody about 4 weeks after I'd started studying the guitar asked me, would you like to give a concert at our Unitarian Church? Well, of course, it was absolute madness to to give a concert when you've been playing the guitar only a month. But I said yes. I mean, I'm sort of stupid, but I thought at least it will force me to study. And so I practiced like mad for a week. But it wasn't really enough, because when the evening arrived, the hall was full, 200 people. And they turned out all the lights, and all they had was a candle on a mantelpiece behind me. If there was one thing I desperately needed, it was to see the strings. And so somehow I didn't manage to play very well that night. But somehow anyway, the whole thing was a great success. God knows how. I remember somebody afterwards saying to me, I'm majoring in music in college, and those were some pretty interesting chords. I said, yes. But anyway, the evening did go well, and I made it interesting with other things. But from then on, my musical, quote, career began, and I've gone on to write over 400 pieces of music, and including sonata, which I'm going to have someone play here, and including a string quartet, which is they say is the most difficult form of music to write, because people hear each note with that. But I don't know, it was no problem for me, because I never did it. So that's the secret of doing things well. Don't do them, but do them. Do them, but let God do it through you. You'll be amazed at the things you can do. So anyway, this string quartet just disappeared. I heard the notes, wrote them down. It was beautiful. And actually, it's a good piece. It's called, it's from Shakespeare's songs, because one day I decided it takes so much work to figure out words, lyrics, with rhymes and everything. Why don't I just write a few songs for Shakespeare's melodies, lyrics? Because some of his lyrics are usually meaningless, but great fun, and a beautiful flow to them. So in 3 days, I wrote 18 of those. And the string quartet takes four of those melodies. And anyway, I think you would like it too. And basically, my music is a very important offering, because what it does, I've heard these things. There isn't a note that I've written thinking, how do I want the music to go? I said, I want the music to say this, 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 and this. And I said, give me a melody. And that a melody appears just like that in my mind, really within seconds. As long as it takes me to write it, it takes me to hear the melody and write it down. And so I found that with this great blessing, this music isn't entertaining. It's a different category of music, because it uplifts the soul. It has an effect upon your inner feelings. I know that two people, Bhagavati, whom you heard sing today, when she first heard that we only perform my music, she thought she was a well-known flute player, and she thought, I can't imagine singing only, playing only one person's music, but she does that now. And David Eby was a part of a well-known quartet, string quartet, and he thought, well, this music is just too simplistic. And he then he started to sing a song that he'd been asked to sing at a concert. And he started to sing it, and he began to become so moved that he had to take his car to the side of the road and stop so that he could control himself. And he realized that this music really has power. There's no complexity in it. It's childlike in its simplicity. But somehow it has an effect upon the spirit. And from now, from then on, that's the only music he plays. So this is one service I've rendered, Master. I've done other things and done my best, but cooperative communities was perhaps the most important thing. And I thought, well, Daya doesn't want to start a community, therefore I'm free to start my own. And with that motive in mind, I began Ananda. So everything I've done has not been done for Kriyananda, but for Yogananda. And I hope you all understand that truth, because it is a truth that can penetrate deeply into your lives and change them for the good. I would like, I think I've said quite enough, in fact, good God, 1 o'clock. Anyway, I'm very happy to have shared with you. And now I would like the choir to sing a little bit. I may sing a song or two. The trouble that I have, frankly, is that I really have become, I've reached a point in my life where it's hard for me to sing deeply moving songs. I break into tears and can't sing. So I will try to sing two songs of mine that I think are especially beautiful. Then the choir will sing. Then Todd Billingsley will play the sonata that I wrote. I wrote a piano sonata, and I'll let you hear that. And that'll be that, I think. Anyway, Todd, would you come and I'll try to sing these songs.
Truth that makes us ever free. joy fill our days. Oh, Master, may thy wisdom guide our way. Oh, Master, may thy joy fill our days.
One thing that Sean said, that all these songs were composed by me. The words of this song were composed by me, but the music was composed by Mukti, who was a member of Ananda for some time. And I want to let everybody know it was her melody. So then, help me to stand up. Jyotish, come up here. I'm going to sing you two songs, and then we'll have a final song. Stand next to me. Emerald Isle, Todd. I only hope that I'll get through this, because the melody is so beautiful. My song is the story of deer on the hills, of larks that soar seeking the sun, of nightingales lifting the curtain of night, as with music they bring down heaven's blessing of light. Oh, my song is the story of God's blessing. Sing of light. Come join me in singing of that emerald isle, of flowers that like jewels besprinkle the lea, of waterfalls eager to embrace the wide sea, as we with our Maker united. As we with our Maker reunited would be. Come here while I sing of emerald hills, of valleys and meadows so fair, that all who have seen them have carried away memories in their hearts, friends, like the lilacs of May. Oh, my song is the story of the lilacs of May. Well, I got through it anyway. And this was A minor. A minor. This is my favorite song. Love is a Magician. love is all I know. Sun rays on the snow of a winter long, in darkness without song. Oh, my heart's a fire, burning all desire. Only you remain, and life again. Too long I did stray, flung lifetimes away, imagined you did not care. I know now your smile was mine all the while. I listened and love was there. I can't breathe for love. All the stars above call to me, come home. Life's waves all end in foam. Only love can heal all the pain I feel. What a fool was I to turn away. Keep going. Love is all I know, sun rays on the snow of a winter long, in darkness without song. Oh, my heart's a fire, burning all desire. Only you remain, and life again. Too long I did stray, flung lifetimes away, imagined you did not care. I know now your smile was mine all the while. I listened and love was there. I can't breathe for love. All the stars above call to me, come home. Life's waves all end in foam. Only love can heal all the pain I feel. What a fool was I to turn away. Then peace. Now this song, Come With the Choir, we need you in this one. This was, give me a napkin there. Very embarrassing to me, but I can't help it. So live with it. This song was based on a story I wrote when I was 15, when I was 18. It's called The Singer and the Nightingale. And the reason for the story was explained as somebody saw a poster for a concert given by a famous singer, and it was called Melody in A. So he turned to a bystander, Melody on A, and he thought, a melody on one note? You can't have a melody on one note. So he turned to a bystander and said to him that should be obviously Melody in A, not on A. And the bystander said, no, it's on A. And then he told the story of this famous singer who one night had lost his voice. And he didn't know what to do. And then he went to some nightingale. He gave a big party for everybody to say goodbye to his public. And he didn't like to be at his own funeral. And he went out onto the terrace in the back of his home. And the little nightingale said to him, why are you crying? And he said, because I've lost the only gift I have to share with people. And he said, the nightingale said, we've been wanting to help you, but you always kept your window closed because you thought you had a cold. But I think we can help you if you will come with me. And the singer was thinking, well, why should I remain here for my own funeral? Let me follow him. So he went with the nightingale into the forest, and there the queen of the nightingales said that to sing well, you have to imitate the tone of another. This is what my singing teacher said to me, that to learn to sing well, I can't show you a voice the way I can a piano. She said, the only way that you can learn to sing is to listen to me singing the right placement, and then imitate that. And I remember I was with her for about 6 months, and one song, she stopped me after several months. She said, that note, that's the way all your notes should sound. And she was a very good teacher. I remember later I went to Mexico City, and the leading voice teacher there said, never change your teacher. And in fact, I think that's why I have a good voice, because I know how to place my voice. I know that if the crowd is larger, I have to bring my voice forward. These things you don't know. But I've discovered other truths, too, that if you sing from different chakras, the tone of the voice changes. Anyway, this is by the way today. And so I thought that melody in on A was a joke. But many years later, I tried to write it, and I tried to make it amusing, but God took over, and he wouldn't let me write a joke. And so this turned out to be actually a serious song and a beautiful one, even though it's all on one note. So now I'm going to sing to you Peace. Peace gave us the mountains, peace gave us the sky. Nightly when starlight enfolds us, peace is its lullaby. Amen. Amen. Peace gave us the morning. Peace gave us the sun. Bird songs that call us to welcome day and fresh labors begun. Amen. Amen. Peace gave us the seasons. Peace gave us the rain. Cool clouds that gather to bless us. Missed hands that soothe away pain. Join us in the final Amen. Finally, Todd Billingsley will play a sonata that I've written, which is called The Divine Romance. And I'll have you all not sing the first movement, but I've also written a song for the first movement, words for the first movement. What happened was that I played it for a member of Ananda, who's not quite our friend these days, Sundaram, and he criticized it, saying it should have words in the first movement. Well, I'm willing to listen to anybody, and so I thought that would be a nice thing to do. So I wrote words later, and they also are beautiful. But this will be just the sonata, not the choir singing that. They do, however, as is written in the music, sing a few words in the last movement. So let me get down there, and then you can begin, Todd. So. very much. Okay, the day is over. Not the day, my part. You won't get away from me that easy. I'll be back later.